Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Ex parte Judy Swake, an original habeas corpus proceeding. Concord Oil and Kinstrol Royalties Corporation versus Pennzoil Exploration and Production Company and others from Hawker County. And Park Place Hospital and others versus the estate of Lola Milo and others from Jefferson County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. These arguments are being recorded for the court. If you desire to purchase a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk and pay a modest fee. The court is ready to hear argument from a relator in ex parte Swake.
May it please the court. Mr. Sean Casey will present argument for the relator. Relator has reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please the court, counsel? I'm going to initially address, if I may, what I perceive as the defenses that were raised in the response brief by the real party in interest, Mr. Eichenberg, the receiver, and the person for whom he is trying to collect the debt for, Ms. Hartwell. The first argument they've raised is that my filing on behalf of my client an application for writ of habeas corpus is an attempt to substitute as a regular appeal. I wish to point out that my habeas corpus is within the parameters of what a habeas corpus is for, and that is namely to find the commitment and contempt orders void. You could take, if you like, and discharge or ignore the other pleadings and orders that relate to the turnover order. And the fact that you'll recall, I did not even, when I filed this and initially was granted bond on behalf of my client by this court, I didn't even file a statement of facts. I'm here suggesting to this court that the orders of commitment and contempt themselves are void and that this is not any attempt to do something by a regular appeal. The orders themselves on their face are what's void.
You could have appealed, I suppose.
I'm sorry?
You could have appealed, I suppose.
Well, you could have appealed the turnover order, that's correct. That is subject to a regular appeal. But at this point in time, in terms of the contempt itself, I mean, obviously all I had was the habeas method in order to release my client from jail. Further, the second argument was that they said that I did not raise defenses at the trial court level. And they cite in their brief a number of cases that talk about if you want to raise...
Casey, I appreciate you going right into the legal issues, but the facts are very convoluted in this case. At least for my purpose, I think at least a minute or two recitation of the facts of the case would be helpful, because I don't find anywhere in the case where Ms. Swake is a judgment debtor. And if she's not a judgment debtor, how can there be a turnover order? So I think it would be helpful to trace some of the procedural history of the case.
Very good, Your Honor. In terms of the history, and I will tell the court that obviously I got on the tail end of this particular history for the habeas itself, and because I was specifically addressing the voidness of the order because I thought it had to be limited in scope. But in terms of the order, as I understand it was, is that there was a first Mrs. Swake, which was Ms. Hartwell now. She had a judgment, a post-divorce judgment, resulting in something out of their original divorce decree.
But the judgment was against her ex-husband.
Against Mr. Swake.
Not to Mr. Swake.
That's correct. There's never been a judgment per se against my client. At some point in time, the second Mrs. Swake, which was my client, also got a divorce out of the 312 court. This court will notice that this particular order was out of the 309. The judgment was out of the 309. In the 312 court, at that point in time, there was a judgment and there were certain funds that were found to be and segregated as the second Mrs. Swake's separate property, my client's separate property. Because Mr. Swake perfected an appeal of that second divorce, at that point in time the money was put into the registry of the court of the 312. At some point in time then, the first Mrs. Swake had gotten a judgment and furthermore had gotten a receiver appointed in the person of Mr. Eichenberg, at which point in time they then filed an intervention in the 312. In other words, an intervention in the second divorce case asking that any funds that be dispersed, that their interest be looked after and fees be assigned or paid over in satisfaction of this judgment. At that point in time, the intervention, I believe, on November the 6th, was, and there's a copy of one of the exhibits, the 312, Judge Webb, the trial judge of the 312, dismissed the intervention.
And there was no appeal for the denial of intervention.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. I think that's a very cognizant point, because my client is being attacked for the purpose that, you know, we're trying to sit there and set aside a turnover order when we should have done it by direct appeal, when in fact I think the turnover order is an attempt to collaterally attack this failure of the 312 to allow the intervention to stand. So I appreciate the justice understanding that point. But anyway, at that point in time, after the intervention was denied, then my client did in fact remove the funds because his appeal was unsuccessful. There was a disbursement of the funds. And again, these funds at that point in time had been legally found to be the separate property and were segregated as the separate property of my client. At that point in time, that's when the turnover order came about, and they indicated that they were claiming that they have a right to these funds and that they in fact should be turned over to Mr. Eichenberg as part of his satisfaction of the judgment.
Up to this point, no, she in no way is a judgment debtor.
That's correct.
To the receiver or to the parties who the receiver represented.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I mean, from my thinking, I still don't think she is a judgment debtor in the classical sense, in terms of if the turnover order is not acceptable, the awarding of attorney's fees. She is not a judgment debtor in terms of the monies that are owed in satisfaction of that judgment, which is due owing from the first owing Mrs. the first Mrs. Swaite from Dr. Swaite.
Can we move on then now to the contempt?
Yes, sir. In terms of the contempt itself, the arguments that I've posed are basically four.
Well, before then, maybe skip a step.
Are you talking about factually?
Factually, how do we get to the contempt?
Very good, Your Honor. I'm sorry. In terms of the contempt, there was the turnover proceeding filed, and then there was a motion filed for contempt for enforcement. And on the motion for contempt and enforcement, again, one of my arguments is nowhere in there are they specifically asking for jail time. But they have the motion for contempt, they file it, and at that point in time, there are some mandamuses filed. There is, because there was a bankruptcy filed in there, and so there was a stay order. And what happened is that on September the 7th, I believe they actually had a hearing. There was a mandamus filed that was conditionally granted, and then it was subsequently dismissed. And when I say dismissed, the court dismissed it. And then at that point in time, an order was actually put in on the 10th. And the oral rendition on the 7th indicated that payment had to be made of the $10,000 in order for 3 days in jail, and payment of $10,000, but could be purged if there was some arrangement to make up other payments that had come out of the registry of court and to make some attorney's fees. They signed this order on the 10th and said all of these things had to be done. Then there was a compliance hearing.
All these things are a little hard on me.
They're hard on me as well, Your Honor, and I apologize. The receiver at that point in time comes back in the 309th court. All this now is taking place in the 309th. There's nothing further happening in the 312. In the 309th court, the receiver gets the order that's signed on September the 10th. Also at that time, a compliance hearing is set. Finally, in January of 1994, they then have the compliance hearing, at which point in time they put in what is known as the commitment order. And at that point in time, she is incarcerated, and they seek application for the 14th Court of Appeals. She was released on $500 bond, and after hearing and an opinion, the 14th Court of Appeals found that the writ should not be granted.
And Mr. Casey, is there any, the judgment against Mr. Sway occurred while he was married to the second Mrs. Sway?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor.
Can that judgment be collected against community assets of that second marriage?
Your Honor, in terms of collection, I don't believe so, because my understanding that in terms of against community. Yes, I think it can't possibly under the family code be collected against community assets.
Is it significant to our inquiry in this case? I mean, is it relevant to the inquiry whether or not the trial court in the second divorce divides this money between Mrs. Swate and Mr. Swate with respect to whether the money that's in that pot is subject to this judgment?
Well, I don't think that's, I mean, in terms of subject to a judgment, my analogy would be just as if you've got a judgment abstracted out there, you know, when persons get divorced, I don't think there's any necessity in the divorce decree to say this is or this isn't, you know, subject to that, you know, particular piece of property. And so I don't think the very fact that the judgment was not mentioned in the divorce decree itself, you know, had any bearing.
I guess my point is there's no question that whoever was seeking to enforce that judgment could trace these community funds regardless of what the family court says about where the funds go.
I don't think there's any dispute that they were community funds that were partitioned at the time of the divorce, if that's what you're asking.
No, my question is there any question about whether the first Mrs. Swate, being a judgment creditor, could go after those funds that were awarded in the divorce court to the second Mrs. Swate?
Well, I would, again, when you're talking about the problem is, you know, when you do a partition in terms of those funds, supposedly there's some sort of quid pro quo, but I'm assuming that she could have made some claim as she tried to do via the intervention route and could lay a claim to that.
Let me take you to one of the issues that you've raised regarding the vagueness of the enforcement part of the order, the payment above $39,000 some odd upon making satisfactory provision for that. If that argument is sound, does it relieve the relator of the criminal punishment, the fine, and the imprisonment?
Your Honor, I believe it does because those cases, you know, stemming from Jenikoff, and it's not something that can be split. Also, basically, what this court will be doing is reforming the criminal sentence, and there's a criminal case law that indicates that you cannot reform a criminal sentence in a non-jury criminal trial, and that's that particular site is Bogany versus State, which can be found at 661 Southwest 2nd 957, which is a Texas Court of Criminal Appeals case. And there's also one out of the 14th Court of Appeals, King versus State, 710 Southwest 2nd 110, and that's in 1987. So my feeling is because you're talking about one particular incident and all of a sudden you are reforming that sentence, I think that's a void action.
But the requirement of making suitable arrangements for payment is separate from the 3 days in jail and the $500 fine. And you say you can't separate those.
That's correct. Because, I mean, basically, on that line of the cases that stem from Jenikoff, what they're saying is if you can separate incident by incident, so in other words, you've got punishment for incident A and you got punishment for incident B, then okay, if the punishment for incident B is no good, you can throw that out and leave the incident A. But what we've got here is one incident where she failed to turn it over, and so all of that punishment comes under that one particular incident, and so therefore the entire punishment has to be thrown out.
But part of it is a punishment, part of it's remedial, and in your view that doesn't keep that rule from applying.
Well,
the payment of money is not something that the judge could have punished her by. He could impose only a $500 fine in those circumstances.
Right. I don't think that you can distinguish the two. The other question that to me is even more basic is this idea that it's not imprisonment for debt. I mean, there's clearly attorney's fees that are being coerced. This is not a child support situation. I know of no law that states that you can hold somebody day to day until they make payment of attorney's fees. And so for that reason, I think clearly there's an imprisonment for debt going on here. there's been trying to establish saying, well, this is not a debt. This is punishing for not complying with the order. But again, I think it's just a question of debt, and I don't see how to get around it. Thank
any
you.
Questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear arguments and respond.
May it please the court. Ms. Cheryl Johnson will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, I'd like to address a couple of the questions that came up earlier as far as the history of the case. I do think that it is somewhat confusing. What happened in this case is that Mr. Swate, or Dr. Swate, who was an attorney as well as an MD, had a practice, and he had some money that was owed to him from the practice. In the course of the divorce, $49,000, which was owed to him by his law firm, was deposited in the registry of the 312th District Court. That was money that had been earned by Dr. Swate. It was his sole management community property. It was never in the possession of Mrs. Swate. It had never become her separate property. In the course of the divorce, the parties, Dr. and Mrs. Swate, never informed the 312th District Court that the judgment against Dr. Swate in almost $600,000 had been rendered in favor of Mrs. Hartwell. That was never brought to the attention of the 312th District Court. The court awarded the money that was in the registry of the court, the $49,000, to Mrs. Swate. However, Mrs. Swate did not obtain possession of that money until May the 12th, 1993. As it occurred, on May the 10th, 1993, the 309th District Court had ordered Mrs. Swate, or Mrs., yes, Judy Swate, to turn over any funds that she obtained from the registry of the court to John Eichenberg.
At that point, counsel, can you tell me if there was a hearing on that turnover order? Or any notice to Mrs. Swate?
There certainly
before
was.
Before the order was issued?
Yes, Your Honor, there certainly was. I was present. And there was a hearing. In fact, there were two hearings.
She was served with a turnover order?
She was served with the order. Her attorney was served with that order, which Judge Montgomery signed on May the 10th. On May the 11th, the day after that order was signed, Mrs. Swate took the money out May the 12th. The next day.
You're saying that whatever notice she got through service?
On her attorney, who was also served with notice of the hearing before it took place and was served with the order after it was signed.
Was there a hearing prior to the issuing of the order? There,
yes.
You say there's notice.
Yes, Your Honor, there's
is a hearing in our in the record?
I don't believe that it's in this court's record. I think that there is a transcript of the September 7th contempt hearing, but that clearly did take place and is part of the Court of Appeals record, if I recall properly. I hope I'm not mistaken on that.
And in that hearing, Mrs. Hartwell justified by some sort of right that she was entitled to those funds?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that Mrs. Hartwell and her attorney did not appear, although they were properly noticed of the hearing.
But who had the burden of proof to go forward? You know, the judge, so sponte did the turnover order? Who was this before the judgment creditor? Anybody?
Well, Your Honor, we were present, John Eichenberg was present through me at the hearing in order to pursue these funds.
What evidence did you present?
Your Honor, that the funds were uncontestedly money that had been earned by Mr. Swate through his law firm. They were his sole management community property and therefore subject to execution by a creditor, a judgment creditor.
Had you already made these arguments in the 312th District Court?
We did, Your Honor. They had not been made, I believe, at that time.
Why were you in the 309th and not the 312th?
Because the 309th was the court court which had granted the judgment, the $579,000 judgment in favor of Mrs. Hartwell. And it was through the 309th District Court that the post-judgment proceedings were being carried forward. the collection efforts were being made in the 309th. It was unfortunate that the two courts for a while were kind of going against each other in these proceedings. The 312th was doing a divorce, the 309th was doing a judgment. And the judgment came first by approximately a month before the divorce happened in the 312th.
When was the intervention, when you were denied intervention?
The denial of the intervention happened approximately 4 months after the divorce took place.
Was it before or after May the 10th?
It was before. Before May the 10th.
You had made these arguments in the 312th.
Actually, we had never had an opportunity to make them. The 312th had just not been willing to consider an intervention because the divorce had already happened. And they said, it's too late. We don't want to hear any of your arguments because the divorce is over with.
You did not appeal that?
No, Your Honor, that was not appealed. The problem with that is that I don't think that a judgment creditor, in order to preserve rights, is required to intervene in a divorce. It's just like a mortgage holder on a house is not required to intervene to preserve the lien. It's there, and the third-party creditor's rights are not going to be damaged by the fact that a divorce has taken place.
Counselor, do you concede the fact that Mrs. Swate was not a judgment debtor?
Oh, she was not a judgment debtor.
Well, then, if she was not a judgment debtor, how could you get a turnover order against her?
Your Honor, because the money we were getting was not her money. It was
the court adjudicated it was her money.
No, Your Honor, the 312th District Court.
The court had allowed her to take the money out of the receiver's service.
That's correct. The 312th District Court had awarded that money to Mrs. Swate in ignorance of the fact that there was a judgment.
Whether it was ignorance or not, the court said, it's your money, you can take it.
That's correct.
So there was a valid court order saying, these are your funds.
That said that she could take them. It didn't say, the order that said she could take them didn't say, these are your funds. It said you
well,
are entitled to take them out of the registry of the court.
She was awarded the funds out of the marital estate.
She was awarded the funds in the divorce decree, and the order that allowed her to take them out allowed her to withdraw them from the registry of the 312th District Court.
Well, help me understand how you can get a turnover order against a person who's a stranger to the lawsuit and is not a judgment debtor.
Well, Your Honor, the funds were sole management community property that had been her husband's earnings. They were going into her hands, into her possession, pursuant to the divorce decree, but a judgment creditor, Mrs. Hartwell, was attempting to follow those funds and to collect those funds to partially satisfy her judgment.
I guess a stranger to a lawsuit.
A stranger to the divorce. Mrs. Hartwell was a stranger to the divorce, Mrs. Swate was a stranger to the judgment.
She was not a party.
That's correct.
So she wasn't.
She was not a party. But she was obtaining funds that were, in fact, completely subject to collection under the family code. And there's no way that two spouses should be able to divide their assets, allow the creditor, the judgment creditor out there, to watch the money just go to the other spouse, and the other spouse can say, well, I was never the judgment debtor, so it's now my separate property, and you can't ever have it.
The order allowing her to withdraw the funds was agreed to by the judgment creditor.
The order allowing Mrs. Swate?
To withdraw funds from the registry of the 300 and whichever court.
12, yes. No, it was not agreed to, Your Honor. It was
the
not
one in the record is signed as having been agreed to.
No, Your Honor, there was an agreement between Mrs. Swate and her husband's attorney, but not an agreement ever between Mrs. Swate and either Mr. Eichenberg or Mrs. Hartwell.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying that the judgment debtor and the
and his to-be-ex spouse.
Yes, who took the money, that order allowing that payment was agreed to.
Yes, Your Honor, that Mr. Swate had no problem letting her have it rather than letting Mrs. Hartwell have it. But that really doesn't solve the problem. He was more than willing to let her have his money rather than the debtor, the judgment creditor.
It seems to be minimal cooperation between the two district courts in this case. Is that true or is that unfair?
Your Honor, for a while there was confusion. Ultimately, the 312th realized where we were coming from and, in fact, ordered Mrs. Swaite to give us the money, too. But that was much further down the road, and it's not part of any of our records. It was just unfortunate because of the closeness of time. Things were out of kilter, or out of sync for a while.
Ms. Johnson, the order says that she can purge herself, Ms. Swaite, of contempt if she makes suitable arrangements for payment. Why is that not so vague that makes the contempt order void?
Your Honor, it's not too vague because it's subject to common sense. This lady was specifically found in the order of contempt to have sufficient resources to be able to make arrangements. And in fact, it left her some room to either sign a note or to sell assets or to make some kind of written arrangement that would allow her over whatever period of time was reasonable to pay back these funds. Your Honor, I thought about this, and all over the state, judges are ordering people to answer interrogatories, to just answer the interrogatories that they have failed to answer. People can't. They shouldn't be able to come back and say, well, you didn't tell me how long to make my answers or how detailed to make my answers.
But that doesn't need the agreement of the other party.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
It would not need the agreement. In this case, suitable arrangements depended on the receiver agreeing.
Your Honor, yes, everyone would have to be in reasonable good faith to make it work, and I think they would have been had there been the slightest effort made to try to make it work. She had the assets, she clearly had the funds available, but she never made even the slightest attempt to make this arrangement work, to make any kind of arrangement, nor did she make the slightest effort to pay the $10,000 which she had testified was in her possession at the time. So she took funds which, from the creditor's point of view, were not her funds. This had been argued for quite some time before May the 10th of 1993. Then what happened is that Mrs. Swaite, got the money on May the 12th. She then took the money and more or less disappeared and claimed she never knew about the order, which was personally delivered to her attorney's office on May the 11th. She didn't know anything about it until July the 8th, she testified. Then she learned about it through her second set of attorneys. And at that point, she made no effort to make any compliance with the court's order, and eventually the contempt hearing took place on September 7th. The order was signed on September 10th. This is still 1993. The court gave her time to comply and time to make these arrangements. She never went back to the court, and I think this is significant, that Mrs. Swaite never went back to the court to ask for any clarification. If there was clarification needed, then she should have gone.
Why did she need clarification? She had her money in her pocket.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. She had.
She had no incentive to go and ask. Clarify what? You know, she's got what she wants.
Well, I was talking specifically, Your Honor, about any alleged vagueness in the balance of the order. If there was any unclearness as to what she was supposed to be doing, she should have gone back to the trial court. She had 4 months between the time of the order of contempt on September the 10th and then the compliance hearing on January the 21st, 1994. She had all that period of time in which she could have...
Counsel, you shifted focus to Mrs. Swaite, which is fine, but going back to Mr. Spector's question, why is to make suitable arrangements not vague, but particularly when it takes the party that's receiving the money, has the control as to whether or not whatever arrangements are made are suitable or not? Why is that not vague?
Well, Your Honor, because I think it's subject to a reasonableness test. If she had made some arrangements, and if Mr. Eichenberg had said, well, those are not suitable, then we would have had to start completely over again. We would have gone back to the court. We would have had a new proceeding to determine whether her arrangements were suitable or not. That she would have at least complied with the order that was in front of her, and she didn't even make the slightest effort to do so.
If that portion of the order is too vague, does that vitiate the rest of it?
No, Your Honor, it
Why
shouldn't.
Not?
Because, Your Honor, the things that are specific that are there that she needs to do, such as pay the $10,000 that she had in her possession, why should she not be required to do that? If, in fact, we're correct and that money was never her money to just grab and run off with, then she should put it back. She should pay what she had. And I don't think that the court's order was unreasonable. If we're correct, and if she had, she took money that was not hers, that she knew she shouldn't have been taking without paying attention to the Judge Montgomery's order, then how do you, what do? You require her to sell assets? You require her to sign a promissory note? She needs to make arrangements to pay that money back. And I think the court was giving her room to do that, to do
why isn't it unconstitutional imprisonment for debt?
Because we're not collecting a debt from Mrs. Swaite. We are trying to collect money that was her husband's sole management community property, which she took, and she was trying to change the characterization of that money into her separate property. That was not collecting a debt from her. It's trying to execute against the money that was clearly subject to execution that was her husband's.
So this is kind of like a sequestration.
I guess it could be similar, Your Honor. I think of it as sort of like if the divorce court had awarded her the house and the husband the debt, the lien holder out there is not going to say, well, I guess I can't get the house because he's not paying the debt. As far as the third party goes, the lien is still against the house.
You say, though, that she's not entitled to this money.
She was not entitled to this money.
She owes it to the receiver.
Right, that's our position, Your Honor.
But that's not a suit for debt.
That's correct. It's not a suit for debt. We're not trying to get the money from her. We were
trying. But if she pays you the money, then you're okay.
That's right. At any rate, I do think that it can be separated. I think that the contempt cases are troubling because they do go to the dignity and the power of the court, and how does the court enforce its orders? If the court has ordered someone to do something, like it ordered Mrs. Swaite to, if she took the money out of the registry of the 312, give it to John Eichenberg. It had been determined to be Mr. Swaite's earnings. It was going to go to the prior judgment creditor, and she wouldn't do it. But how do you deal with that? How does the court protect the constitutional rights of Mrs. Swaite and at the same time protect its own dignity and power and to be able to enforce its own orders? And I think that Judge Montgomery did it. I think he made a very detailed contempt order. He also gave Mrs. Swaite, she had plenty of time in which to clarify or to go back and ask the court what to do or take steps, which she didn't do. Certain complaints that she never made to the trial court, which she has raised here. And those complaints should be waived.
Counsel, are there any limits to a turnover order?
Limits?
Yes, ma'am.
I think there must be, Your Honor, but...
What are they? What are those limits?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Can you get a turnover against a stranger?
Your Honor, I think that if a stranger is holding assets that belong to a judgment debtor, then I think a turnover order can be, if I recall properly, can be properly directed to that third party.
Without that third party being a judgment debtor?
Excuse me?
Without that third party being a judgment debtor?
Yes, Your Honor, if that third party is holding assets that belong to someone else.
In Beaumont Bank v. Buller, we held that the turnover statute does not authorize a court to issue orders against those who are not judgment debtors. Why is this Beaumont Bank not dispositive of this case?
Because, Your Honor, we're not talking about collecting the debt out of the assets of Mrs. Swaite. We're talking about requiring Mrs. Swaite holding assets that really belong to Mr. Swaite.
But she had a court order directing her, allowing her, and you keep saying they are Mr. Swaite's funds, but the 312 have directed that they were her funds. So how do you get around that?
Well, Your Honor, the 312 had awarded those funds to her in the divorce, not knowing about the judgment.
Irrespective of that, there was a valid order. She lawfully withdrew them from the registry of the court, and they were her funds. Then how do you get around that?
Well, Your Honor, the character of the funds didn't change by the fact that she took them out of the registry of the court. By the act of taking them out, they didn't become instantly her separate property. Their character was still the source of the funds. They were Mr. Swaite's earnings.
And they in response to Justice Rudolph's question, she still was not a judgment debtor. How do you get around the Beaumont decision?
Well, Your Honor, because we're not trying to collect out of her assets, we're collecting against Mr. Swaite's assets that she was holding in her possession. And I think that's an important distinction. It's true that she had them in her possession, but I'm really concerned that if by divorce parties can divide their money by agreement, and then and then by agreement, as soon as the other spouse, the non-debtor spouse, gets those that property in his or her possession, it's instantly immunized from any kind of tracing or follow through by a creditor, then that's going to be very troublesome.
How is she different from anyone else who is charged with a turnover order? Why do you not have to first get a judgment against her just like you would any other creditor? Or anyone else who held Mr. Swaite's funds?
Well, Your Honor, I think anyone who held Mr. Swaite's funds would be in her position. That they would be required. In fact, we had to do that a couple of times, get people to relinquish funds that belonged to Mr. Swaite that they happened to be holding.
If this had been his law firm, wouldn't you first have to get a judgment against the law firm under the Beaumont decision?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because that money was not the Beaumont firm's money. It was already Mr. Swaite's money. Once it was Mr. Swaite's money, whoever was holding on to it should be required to turn it over to the receiver.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
May I please the court?
Would a garnishment have been proper for her?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Would a garnishment proceeding have been proper?
Your Honor, I think the real question is she keeps saying these funds are Mr. Swaite's, and she's trying to adjudicate that these funds are Mr. Swaite's by a turnover order. So, you know, my feeling is if a garnishment action had been filed at that point in time, there would have been a dispute as to whether or not those were, you know, appropriately garnishable, because I don't think anybody knows with the paper trail that we've got right now whose funds those really are. She just says, well, these are his funds, so therefore you turn over some. You know, basically, I'm in disagreement with her that these funds were Mr. Swaite's.
Mr. Casey, I thought you conceded that these were community funds that were being distributed.
I understand the community funds that at the time of divorce, but once the divorce decree was entered,
But the concession was that regardless of how the court distributes the funds with respect to the spouses, it doesn't affect anyone's else interest in that property.
But because it's community funds, what I'm trying to say is that portion that got partitioned now hers as opposed to his? Because, I mean, there's some quid pro quo over there. You know, he got some things in return, and so it's a partitioning of their community estate. So as of the time the divorce decree was entered, you know, I'm not so sure that they're any longer his funds. When I was answering your question, what I was saying is those funds, as they were at the time of partitioning the divorce decree, were still community funds. But I'm of the opinion that once the divorce decree is over, they're no longer community funds, because the decree clearly states in the order that these are now the separate, you know, estate of the given spouse of which the particular asset is given.
So unless a party who claims an interest in those funds intervenes in the divorce case, their interest is terminated.
Not necessarily, because again, you know, I could see Judge Spector's, if somebody does a garnishment, there might have to be some sort of adjudication of whether or not there's some type of fraud being worked on a creditor or something to that effect. But I know of nothing that shows any type of fraud. I mean, I think this was just an even partition. There may have been other assets. Also, I'd like to address Justice Gonzalez's question about limits of the turnover. Another limit of the turnover order, as I understand it, is that you cannot have assets turned over to an individual, such as Mr. Eichenberg. Mr. Eichenberg was a receiver, but he was not appointed as part of a turnover. You have your assets turned over to a constable, who then at that point in time satisfies those particular things. So not only do I think that they are serving a person who's not a proper party to the turnover order, but I also think that they have used an improper mechanism that the turnover order does not contemplate, namely turning over assets to, you know, basically to the judgment debtor, because as the receiver, now Mr. Eichenberg is actually in the shoes and in the position of being the judgment, student's judgment creditor. So I think, again, that part was improper. In answer to Justice Spector's question, I think that Ms. Johnson, she says, well, if it wasn't reasonable, they're all going to do it in good faith, you know, they'll go back to the court. But that's not how a sentence, we've got to remember this is a criminal proceeding, and the person who determines whether a sentence has been in fact served and satisfied is not the court, but the sheriff. It's the jailer. And so if this was to allow the stand, the person that's going to determine whether or not they've got a good agreement or whether it's reasonable or whether it's met some other type of test that she has served her sentence allowing her to get out is going to be the sheriff. And you don't go back to the court. And that's the same as you may recall the case you previously cited, the Roost case, and there's another one I can't remember, but talks about when the court in its order said, we're not going to let him off for any good time for good behavior. And the court has held, the court does not have the ability, once that sentence has been imposed, to sit there and put the restrictions on that sentence. It's literally got to be read from the face of the document, and it's up to the sheriff to determine whether or not that particular sentence is reasonable. And so, again, I think you're putting the sheriff into an impossible situation. Because obviously if these two people do not get along, which I think is fairly apparent, and then we're going to try to decide who's dealing in good faith and who's not. Separate and apart from the facts, which again I think in terms of the turnover order, and I will freely say I'm a little off guard here because when I do these habeas things, I sort of look at the order and try to sit there and focus on, you know, what's a void order as opposed to trying to pull out the past sins of the various parties on other cases.
Which you really haven't done in You're not trying to do that.
Exactly, which is why I'm a little slow on my...
It's all come up today.
On my response to questions. And part of it is because I wasn't there. And the second part is I really, you know, my feeling is just looking at the order itself. Looking at the order itself, I do not think that my client can be remain to be incarcerated. I think the arguments that I've made, you know, the fact that there is additional stuff that's gone from the time that she was found in contempt, you know, to make arrangements, to make payments, that was not part of the original order. It was a purging provision as a probation deal, but then they actually made it part of her sentence in the commitment. By the very fact that they've got attorney's fees that have to be paid, and this is not a child support, again, just looking at the order, I'm of the firm opinion that this is imprisonment for debt. I don't see how you can get around it. In terms of the weakest argument that I've got there, I'll acknowledge the weakest one, is the fact that they've got the contempt motion itself. And the contempt motion itself has nothing in the prayer. If you will look at that there, and you'll see nothing in the prayer that says, I want this person imprisoned. The prayer is, I want money turned over to me. And so for that reason, I think just looking at the documents itself, as opposed to the past history of the parties, that the habeas should be unconditional.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.
Right, please.